For the week of January 28th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 397, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
In Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Gilse. That's Birmingham with a B, and that's B for birthday, because it's your birthday, Sperling.
Yes, it is. I'm 21 again. It's pretty remarkable.
Oh, my God. You're 87 years young. That's how I think of you.
Yes. Well, I feel 87 years young.
Yes, you do. And what do you want for your birthday, Sperling?
I'd like the construction workers who are outside the studio to finally finish their project, because it's just killing me. And of course, you'll probably hear it throughout the show, because today, of course, all week last week, they were quiet. They weren't doing, but they were painting, very quiet. But today, of all days, they decided, you know what we should do? Install flooring with lots of hammers.
Well, you know, maybe they could take a break. Jump on iTunes and rate and review the show just to celebrate your birthday.
I was wondering where you were going with the iTunes things. Yeah, you probably should, you know, rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, the Microsoft Marketplace, the Google Play Store, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to us, rate and review the show. It does help us out when you do. You can also follow us at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle, or like us on Facebook.
Because they follow us and we follow the news, and then we follow up on the news that we have followed. Because they follow us. And that means We Shall Overcome, the civil rights anthem, around for 100 plus years, is in fact in the public domain. We talked about the story before. They came to a settlement, and yes, we shall overcome. And they did.
Yes. And so we're going to do an entire show where we sing We Shall Overcome. You start, Michael.
I was going to do spirituals. I thought it would be do more than just one song. I was going to start with Wade in the Water, but if you want to start with that, I guess we can. What you should start with is what we're going to talk about on this show.
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've got a lot, okay? The entertainment industry never sleeps, and neither do we. We've got Oscar nominations and Sundance winners and Grammy winners, and already I'm wondering if we can keep the show under 2 hours. Damn it! My New Year's resolution was to stop apologizing for the length of our podcast. Oh, well, we'll be joined by Ann Thompson, IndieWire's editor-at-large, for her rundown of Sundance and expert analysis of the Oscar nominations. That will happen at the end of the show during Inside Baseball, because who's more inside the biz than Ann Thompson? First, we look deeper into MoviePass, the subscription movie ticket service that has taken its battle with the cinema chain AMC up a few notches. An interview with the head of the company revealed some interesting details about their business plans. Could Michael be changing his mind about the company's viability? We'll find out. Yeah, then we try to figure out something interesting to say about the Grammy Awards and the best performances, all while sporting white roses, needless to say. During Book Filter, Michael will offer up a breakout book of popular history that Reese Witherspoon has probably already optioned. Hi, Reese. Thanks for listening. We've got an update on the sexual misconduct revolution. We'll pick the most fascinating or important development of the week rather than running down all the allegations and changes and charges and roiling the industry in a desire to keep it in the spotlight but kind of avoid burnout on the subject. It was either that or launch a second podcast. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gilse to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo. Hey, guys, thanks for listening. You name the LA Times, the New York Times, everybody. And the number three movie around the world.
What? The number three movie around the world?
It's so exciting, I can barely wait. The number three movie around the world is Padmavat, which is an Indian film, a big budget, $30 million movie. It opened up over the weekend. It was already on our radar because it's a controversial film. It tells a legendary story from Indian history revolving around a mythical character, most people would say. It's sort of like a Robin Hood character. It's a woman who is involved with these titans of history, and she chooses to die rather than dishonor her name. And it's a very famous story, but most historians would say it's not true. However, people got very upset about the making of this movie and how it treated Muslims versus Hindus, and it created all sorts of tension in India. I mean, there were riots. People attacked a school bus with children. 300 women petitioned the government and said they wanted to commit suicide to object to the film. I mean, it was just crazy. And it turns out the movie opened happily. Very little has happened since it opened. It got mixed to good reviews, but it has really set some awards in box office. It is in North America. It is in the top 10.
Yes, I know. $9.5 million.
No. In North America, it did not gross $9.5 million in the U.S. It grossed It grossed $4.2 million in North America, which is amazing. It's in the top 10. It also has the highest per screen average of any film on the charts. It's on 324 screens, and it is the highest per screen average in all of North America. It's playing here in Birmingham, Alabama. So it's the first Bollywood film to have the highest per screen average in North America ever. It's in the top 10, which is an exceedingly rare achievement. And it is, where is it in India? It's number one in India. And it is the first Indian film to be released in IMAX 3D. And this is hilarious. Many critics in India criticized the IMAX 3D as unwanted and unnecessary. So that's kind of funny. It warms my heart. But there's also another Indian film called Secret History, which is the number two film in China. So you've got an Indian film in the top 10 in North America with the highest per screen average. You've got it doing another Indian film doing BAFO box office in China. That filmmaker's last film made more money in China than it did in India. This movie, Secret History, might do the same. It's only a matter of time before we see a Bollywood film top the charts in North America. It's going to happen. Hopefully sooner rather than later, you know. So I'm very excited by that. I think that's really a notable big breakthrough for Indian films all over the world. It's exciting to see.
You know, a couple points here. This is how hard it is to track box office. Okay, first of all, ComScore has the film making in North America $9.5 million. You're right, Box Office Mojo only has it making $4.5 million. Okay,
I believe ComScore, that's the worldwide box office. I had to actually pull an Audible and change it in our show notes because ComScore listed making $9.5 million. Where they weren't including markets outside the U.S., outside of India, or they weren't including the box office in India. I think it was one or the other because it's playing in India and China, not China, India, North America, Australia. It's playing a number of territories, and they didn't include the box office in some of them. Indian films, if they don't report to ComScore, ComScore doesn't have the information.
Yeah, you know, I almost went to see this film. Of course, it is playing in 3D near me, which I was not going to do, but I was going to go see it in 2D, except I did not have 3 hours and 11 minutes this weekend to go do it.
I thought it was 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Well, the running time I saw was 3 hours, 11 minutes.
Yes, it is. I almost went to see it too, but I got caught up with the weekend. But I did call an Audible and change the information on what was going on with the movie. So as far as I can determine from a number of charts, ComScore, news stories, some Bollywood stories some stories I saw in the Indian trades, it looks like Padmavat is grossing $22 million worldwide this weekend. So a great start for that. It's not the number one film in the world, though. That is Maze Runner, The Death Cure, the final film in the trilogy, finally opens up in North America, where it's the number one movie, $86 million worldwide. It's at $105 million and counting. So a great finale for this trilogy. The first two made about $300 million. This one most certainly will do the same as well.
Now, remember, this was the film that took a year to release because the star was injured on set.
That's right. Dylan O'Brien was injured. That delayed the ending of the shoot. And there, you know, it came out and people were clearly itching to see the film. They had not forgotten about it because you have to worry about that sort of thing. Even though they were coming out one a year, you don't want to have an extra year where people go, oh, yeah, I forgot about that movie. So that didn't happen here. And they'll certainly be waiting for Jumanji 2 because Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, made another $34 million. It's at $822 million worldwide. Then there's Padmavat, and right below that is Hugh Jackman's The Greatest Showman. Another $20 million on the weekend, $260 million worldwide. So that is a clear-on success story right off the bat with an original movie musical. That doesn't happen a lot. Happened last year or the year before with La La Land, and here we are again. And number five is that other Indian film I was talking about. It's Secret Superstar. It only cost about $2 million to make, I think. It had a great hold in China. It made $19 million over the weekend, and it's at $90 million worldwide. And again, I had to pull out information about what Secret Superstar grossed last year in India and around the world, because this is its final market. But the ComScore notes were just including it as if it was a new release with only China where its box office was being counted. Am I making myself clear?
Sort of, yeah. I have no idea what you're talking about.
They were just saying whatever it grossed in China, that's what they were listing as its total box office, rather than recognizing it had come out months earlier in the rest of the world and had made $50 million. So I think its total in China is about $40, $45 million, and that was what they listed as the total. The total worldwide is $90 million. This is not a knock on ComScore. It's just to say, hey, it's really hard to keep track of worldwide box office, and we want to do the best job we can. So if you ever find out we've made a mistake or we've missed a movie that you look and say, hey, this movie's grossed $7 million this weekend. It should have been on their charts. These guys should have been mentioning it, and they didn't mention it. Let us know.
Yes, you can write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can always follow us on Twitter, as I mentioned, or like us on Facebook.
That's right. Following that are a bunch of movies that are capitalizing on their Oscar nominations, hoping to get a big jump at the box office. That's true for The Post, the Spielberg film starring Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep. Soon Tom Hanks will be playing Mr. Rogers.
I know. Can you believe that?
That makes perfect sense. I guess he won't be playing him as a young man, though.
No.
But because that's a cool, interesting career. There's a new biography out about Mr. Rogers, but I think this is based on an original script. Be interested to see what they do with that. The Post grossed $18 million on the weekend. It's at $80 million worldwide, and it's got a long ways to go. Right below that is Coco, the Disney Pixar animated film, which the people I know who are voting on the Oscars, they get a ballot. They're actually on the animation committee this year. I'm keeping them anonymous since they didn't tell me to say who they were. But they're actually, this year they got chosen or offered or volunteered to deal with animation. So they had to watch like 20 animated movies before they did the watch a whole section of them. And of all the animated movies they've seen, they love Coco. They can't imagine anything else winning. So that's presumably a hot tip on the inside there. It grossed $15 million on the weekend, $680 million worldwide.
Not even the breadwinner? I thought the breadwinner, I don't even know if it was nominated. I have to go back and check.
It was in fact nominated. So was Loving Vincent and a few others. But they're like, no. It's Coco, all the way. And then Coco did get another production design for an animated film, which is exciting to see because it is cool production design and it did deserve that recognition. So that's another, from the art directors recognized that movie as the best designed animated film of the year. So it's good to see the support there from the ACE people. Not the ACE, but the, what's the production design people? You know who I mean.
Yeah.
Below that is Liam Neeson's The Commuter. No Oscar nominations for this movie, but it grossed $14 million and it's at $66 million worldwide. Then there's Gary Oldman's Darkest Hour that is up for the Oscar, doing a great job of positioning itself this year with a nice fall run and still ready to, gain more momentum. $12 million on the weekend and it's just about to hit $100 million worldwide. But the one movie in the top 10 in North America after The Post, I guess The Post is up for Oscars too, isn't it? Sorry about that. You've got The Post and then you have got, it's just out now, is Three Billboards. Three Billboards is doing great still in North America. And worldwide, it has grossed on the weekend $12 million worldwide, $72 million and counting. Ferdinand, the animated film, is
now,
just
now. I wonder if you actually advertised Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri on billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri. Would that be ironic or meta or something?
It should at least get you a news story.
Yeah, exactly.
Right below that is the cartoon Ferdinand, $250 million worldwide. And then below that is Forever Young, the Chinese drama that spans 100 years of history. That's just about to pass the $100 million mark. Pretty darn good for a movie that sat on the shelf for 5 years or so. Then there's the horror film Insidious, The Last Key, $145 million worldwide. And below that, 12 Strong, the Jerry Bruckheimer, no, Afghanistan was a great war. That made $10 million on the weekend, and it's at $35 million worldwide. That's the movie's budget, so now they just need to triple that.
I just looked up Ebbing, Missouri on Google Maps. I don't even think it exists.
I think it's a fake town?
Yes, oh, exactly.
So those billboards could be anywhere.
Otherwise, trust me, Fox Searchlight would have done that by now.
Yeah, they're good at promotions. That's definitely a strong suit of Fox Searchlight. Wonder, the family film, $10 million on the weekend. That's at $265 million worldwide. And then a movie that's not for the family. It's Hostiles, the Christian Bale Western. I've heard some good things about it. I'd like to see it. It's at $12 million and counting. It's finally gone wide here in North America. Below that is Den of Thieves, an action film, probably competing with The Commuter, that Liam Neeson film for their audience. $9 million on the weekend, $31 million worldwide. And then there's that flop Star Wars, The Last Jedi. That passed $1.3 billion. $1.311 billion is where it stands right now. Still making money around the world. It grossed $9 million this weekend. And right below that is Guillermo del Toro's most successful film since Pan's Labyrinth, one of only three films he's made that will make money in its initial theatrical run. It made $9 million on the weekend. It's at $51 million worldwide. It's certainly going to triple the budget by hitting $60 million, but I'm sure this movie has a ways to go all over the world. So that is a real solid success story commercially, along with the critical accolades it has received.
Now, if Pacific Rim didn't make money, which was one of his last films, then why are they making a sequel?
because it was so popular in China. It made a ton of money in China, and I think they've seen stuff about it on DVD and Blu-ray and streaming where they feel like it has built up an audience, and they think there's something to build on there. And I bet they're right. I bet the next one makes a substantial portion more than the original. We'll have to see. But I think that's not a bad bet. I assume that they looked at everything and said, no, you know what? People who liked it, saw it, liked it. They were passionate about it. It's gotten good word of mouth since it's been out of the theaters and available in the home. So I think they're looking at all of that. I think they had a video game pegged to it, all that sort of stuff. Man, it definitely was big in China, and even that alone made it sort of worthwhile to say, let's keep going. Paddington 2 passed $180 million worldwide. And then there's a movie called either My World Only or Keys to the Heart. I've seen both titles. It's a Korean comic drama about a former boxer who retouches or reconnects with his special needs brother, a savant who is great at video games and piano and adorable and funny and yet geeky, of course. So it's a heartwarming family film of a sort. And it's grossed $5 million on the weekend. It's at $13 million worldwide. And jumping down, we had the Met Opera Tosca. They made $4.2 million worldwide. And right at the bottom, I, Tonya passed the $20 million mark, another movie that's doing quite well for its limited budget. And we should talk again about the Russian film Going Vertical. That's the drama about the 72 Olympic basketball team and their scandal when they won the gold medal, as far as the Americans are concerned, or their triumph when they won the gold medal. I finally watched the trailer to this movie. And when you watch that, it's very clear this is not a movie delving into the scandal. This is like Rocky IV, but suddenly it's Draco who's working hard and putting in the hours and the Americans who are evil. And it's the Russians who are really, you know, triumphing with their grit and determination. It's at $45 million. It's in two territories. And it is apparently the highest grossing film of all time in Russia.
Okay, I just looked that up because we were talking about this before we started recording. It is the highest grossing domestic film of all time.
See, I knew that, and they didn't make that qualification. I was trying to look that up, and I depended on you, and you came through. We did mention Paddington 2, by the way. It's now officially the best reviewed movie ever on Rotten Tomatoes.
That's unbelievable.
Except it's unbelievably misleading. It has 167 fresh reviews, which means it's past Toy Story 2, which had 163 fresh reviews. No negatives for either film. They both are 100% fresh and have enough reviews that it count. You know, if you have an obscure movie, one person says it's fine, that would give you 100%. They're only counting movies with substantial reviews, and there are more reviewers now, I guess. So it is past Toy Story 3. What's the other difference
between Toy Story 2 or Toy Story 3? Because I know...
Toy Story 2. So what's the difference other than that between Toy Story 2 and Paddington 2? It's the fact that Toy Story 2 is one of the great films of all time, hugely acclaimed. People claimed it a masterpiece, and you could find it on year-end lists all over the place. Paddington 2 is a movie that most people said, it's fine. It's okay. You can take the kids. It's all right. It is not on any best of the year list as far as I know. Maybe one or two in the UK.
Mainly because it was released in January, but
It was released in the UK. It's not a good movie. Nobody thinks it's one of the best films of the year. Nobody. It will not be on any best of the year list in North America. No, it's not on list because it's not a good movie. And it didn't get good reviews. It got okay reviews. People said it's an okay family film. But that's a thumbs up. And that's how you can get a 100% fresh rating, even though you're just an okay movie.
My kids loved it.
Did you take them to see it with MoviePass?
I did not take
it. Because you wouldn't mind seeing it. Because you'd say, all right, I saw it with MoviePass. I didn't mind. I did. I saw it with MoviePass.
I did not take them to see it with MoviePass because, A, my MoviePass had not arrived yet. Okay, that's number one. And two, you know what? I only have one, so I couldn't take, friends and family. That's one of the downfalls or drawbacks of MoviePass. You pretty much only have one.
And you can't have a MoviePass if you're a kid. You have to be 18 or over in order to get a MoviePass.
That is correct.
Yes. So I found that out when they sent me new terms of service, new terms of agreement for my MoviePass. And I read through it because I thought, I wonder if there's anything interesting in here. And there was. There was also a little notice, and they were explaining why they had removed 10 AMC theaters. Actually, they didn't really explain. That was came in a separate press release. But they said, hey, guess what? We don't guarantee any theater is going to be available. And these theaters are no longer available. And they're all AMC. There are 10 AMC theaters. And I thought, that's interesting. But I knew to expect it because I'd seen a story in The Hollywood Reporter where MoviePass said, hey, you know what? We're going to show AMC. They don't think we matter and they don't care about us. We're going to take away 10 of their theaters. And guess what? They're going to see we're driving business to their competitors. That'll show you AMC. And I thought, that's kind of interesting. And so there was a lot of stuff interesting in that interview. That alone to me said, wow, that's kind of a neat development. Do you think it'll work that they will steer people away from like the AMC Century City 15 in Los Angeles?
Well, certainly they will steer them away from the AMC Century 15 in Los Angeles, except for one thing. There is no place else to go. There's like a few, you know, one screen theaters. You know, there's the Grove. There's the Regal, which is, you know, 15 miles downtown. You know,
that's not a competitor then. That's pretty far away in LA terms.
Correct. And same thing with the Santa Monica theaters. You know, there's an old fourplex and an old sevenplex, both of which are AMCs. But the Century City 15 is one of the highest grossing theaters in the nation. And it is also, you know, the ticket prices are quite high. It's in an urban, densely populated area. They were probably looking at the usage here in a company town. Basically, that is, you want to talk about the epicenter of filmmakers and, you know, movie industry professionals. That's it. AMC Century City 15. There are probably people there who have a lot of time on their hands and who are going, you know, once, twice, three, four times a month, and they are losing money on those customers in that area at that theater. And that is why they did this. The bonus, of course, is that they get to kind of like ding AMC at the same time, but they didn't let anybody know ahead of time. They just kind of like took the theaters off the app, and that's how people found out. And that's when Deadline and The Hollywood Reporter and Variety started reporting that AMC was blocking blocking certain theaters, blocking MoviePass. And AMC had to say, look, we're not blocking anything. We're not doing any, we don't work with MoviePass at all. If any theaters don't show up on MoviePass, that's a MoviePass issue. And MoviePass eventually had to come clean, and you received the letter that you received saying, oh yeah, by the way, there are these 10 theaters that are no longer on the, available through our app. Oh, by the way, they happen to be some of the highest grossing theaters in the nation and some of the highest usage in the nation for our service.
So you think this was trying to make a good point out of a bad situation? They'd cut these theaters to save money. And they needed a good reason for doing that. And so they said, yeah, you know what? We're telling AMC, we're making a point.
Right. And I think that somebody kind of made the observation that MoviePass was probably hoping that their own customers would immediately blame AMC. Because, of course, when MoviePass lowered its price last year from like $50 to $9.99, they, you know, shot up in users from 20,000 to their now past 1.5 million. And AMC immediately said, well, we're not going to work with you. We're even going to try and block you because we don't like what you're doing. You're commoditizing movie going, you're commoditizing movie tickets, and we don't like that. And we don't think it's sustainable in the long run. And you're going to train people to expect to see movies, you know, as many movies as you want for $9 a month. We're not working with you. And the thought was, well, really what they're going to do is what MoviePass is trying to do is get their own customers to blame AMC for blocking these theaters when in fact it was MoviePass that took them off their own app.
Well, they did say some interesting stuff in that interview. That was with Mitch Lowe, correct?
Yes, Mitch Lowe is the former head of Redbox and one of the co-founding executives, not the co-founder, but a co-founding executive over at Netflix.
Right. He said, hey, 11% of the country sees like 18 movies a year. So there were a lot of heavy moviegoers that could still sign up for MoviePass. That might be as many as 20 million people, depending on how you slice and dice the numbers. And I think Hollywood Reporter said, well, hey, have you thought about like limiting Friday, Saturday night, you know, just letting people come on off hours? Maybe the chains would be happier with that. And their response is, well, you know what? That's when our users use MoviePass anyway. They don't tend to go on opening night or the weekend evenings because they can't be guaranteed a ticket till they actually go to the theater. So they're already going during the day, during the weekdays, weeknights, off hours. So they're already training themselves to not go at the peak demand time. Though, frankly, even in New York, unless it's opening weekend of Star Wars, you can be pretty confident you'll get a ticket into anything. And actually, I just went earlier in the day to Star Wars, got a ticket, and I was ready for that evening. So, yeah. You know, you can do that around. I noted in the user agreement, it says they can cancel your MoviePass if on more than one occasion during any 30-day period, you do not view the movie for which you purchased a ticket with in its entirety. Meaning if you leave early, they have the right to cancel your card. And I think what they were saying there is if somebody's trying to game the system and punish us by using a MoviePass every day, 365 days a year, we're not going to let you keep your card.
Right. Now, it used to be that MoviePass would only let you see every single movie once. So you couldn't just go back and see Star Wars every single day.
As far as I know, that's not the case anymore, though I'm not sure if I've seen a movie twice yet or tried to. I'll let you know because I'll have to use MoviePass both times. I'll find out. They did say that they have a discount. You know, one of their goals is to work with theaters and get a discount, meaning you won't charge us full price. You'll get a, you know, you'll get a good amount, but not the actual full amount if we're using MoviePass, because, you know, we're bringing you customers. And they claim to have access to 1,000 screens that give them a discount. If that's so, what chains would it be? It's obviously not AMC.
Well, remember, Studio Movie Grill in Texas, they have, you know, theaters in I think, 9 states, 29 theaters. They have one here in Simi Valley in California. And Goodrich Quality Theaters out of Grand Rapids, Michigan, they have theaters in several states as well.
How many locations do they have?
I know that Goodrich Quality Theaters is like 270, somewhere in that neighborhood. Studio Movie Grill is probably in the 200 range.
You mean screens?
Screens, sorry, yes.
Right. Okay, so that's already halfway there if they have agreements with those two.
Right, and certainly Studio Movie Grill, I think, is kind of an equity owner, or at least was, because they had an ongoing relationship, and they're always touting how MoviePass has helped their attendance. That said, good luck, because I don't see AMC, Regal, Cinemark, any of these big chains offering box office discounts, because it's not a product that they are allowed to discount without going through the studios.
One of the things
the Hollywood Reporter...
How can the small chains do it?
Well, because they are independent films and the distributors don't have as much sway. They don't have as much leverage.
Oh, they're only art house theaters? They don't show Star Wars?
Yeah, more than likely they're probably independent theaters.
I understand the theaters are but they show indie films, you're saying? They don't
Correct.
Show Jumanji?
Well, they probably don't, or not as many.
Well, if they show any, though, do they have the right to discount tickets to that?
They have the right to discount it, provided that the distributor actually gets the full freight. You know,
so they would have to be, they would be losing money.
Correct.
Okay. And they also claim, hey, they've got some revenue. They've got 4 studios signed on to pay for advertising and promoting a movie within the MoviePhone app.
Right. And what they didn't do was tell you whether it was within the MoviePhone app, whether they were email campaigns, because I received an email campaign, an advertisement, go see Wicked, you know, this week. They didn't tell you whether it was that kind of advertising, nor did they tell you exactly what distributors they were. They said studios, but did they mean an independent, or did they mean a Warner Brothers, a Paramount, a Sony Pictures? They didn't kind of define that.
So they were being very careful about what words they use. Well, they did use one word, profitable. They said they can be profitable if they get 3 to 4 million subscribers, which I assume is part of the whole gym membership model. They're hoping to get people sign up who aren't actually going to 18 movies a year.
That's right. I mean, what they're trying to do is get people who go, you know what, look, I know I'm not going to go every month, okay? Let's face it, I'm not going to go every month. But you know what? I'll probably go enough, okay? And if I go like 10 times, that's like $8. That's like, paying, $8 a ticket. That'll be worth it. And well, you know what? That would be worth it, actually, if you were both the customer and MoviePass. That helps everybody out.
Their idea was that people might use MoviePass as insurance, meaning, hey, when you pay a flat monthly fee, if you go to see a movie and you don't like it, you don't feel dumb about leaving. You're like, you know what, why am I still here? I didn't pay for it. I can come back tomorrow or next week and see another movie. It's not good. I can walk out after an hour. We do that in festivals. People do that all the time. They're trying to see as many movies as they can, and they say, this isn't worth my time. I'm not liking this. I'm leaving. But when you pay to see a movie and you pay $15, you're going to sit there till the end. You almost never leave early. And that is sort of a nice freedom, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I rarely ever walk out of a movie.
Yeah, but what if it was free? Well, if you're going to take a chance on a movie that you might not have seen, maybe you'd go see Jumanji and go, all right, I'll go see it. And then you say, it's not that bad. And you stay. Or if it's really bad, you go, I can leave. I don't care. I didn't pay for this particular movie.
Except if I do that, okay? What I love is they tout that as one of the benefits, and then in their terms of service, I would be breaking their terms of service.
Yeah, exactly. It was a bit contradictory. Oh, well, they're a little contradictory. We're a little suspicious. We still don't quite see the path to profitability that they do. We just need more hard numbers. But we know Hollywood has a path to profitability, and that's reboots, sequels, and spinoffs.
Well, yeah, and good grief. I mean, we really have to figure out a new rule about which ones we mention, because let's face it, between, movies where every actor is in tights and wears a cape, and reboots and spinoffs and remakes, that's, that's pretty much all anybody does anymore. So, we could be talking about this all the time. So I don't even know.
Yeah, well, I guess they've always had reboots. You know, you had the new Leave It to Beaver in syndication and TV movies of the Brady Bunch. So it's not that new, but it does seem weird that like Murphy Brown is back. I mean, you could have the all must-see Thursday. It could be the actual same shows 20 years later. Let's just bring back Friends. You know, it's like they would do it all. So we have Murphy Brown this week, 13 new episodes with all the original people involved. Mighty Ducks, the TV series, because, of course, we recognize the name. So why not? CBS has greenlit pilots for Magnum PI and Cagney and Lacey. Ryan Reynolds has signed up a new deal at Fox, and that includes a live-action remake of Clue, the board game movie. The script is going to be written by the guys who did Deadpool 1 and 2. Of course, all they have to figure out now is who actually owns Fox. Warner Animation is making a new feature-length animated film based on The Cat in the Hat. It's also got a TV series based on Green Eggs and Ham. And that vampire spoof, that movie that people love, What We Do in the Shadows, that is coming TV at FX. Charmed is coming to the CW. The Greatest American Hero with a female lead has got greenlit to pilot. Get Christy Love. That's a reboot coming to ABC. It started with the star of Pitch. Pitch?
Oh, you know what? That's that move. That's that TV show where the girl was a pitcher on a professional baseball team.
Kylie Bunbury is going to star in Get Christy Love. That is the first TV drama to star a female lead of color. The second was Scandal with Kerry Washington. That's how rare it is for have a black woman star in a TV drama on network television. So that's long overdue. And we do have a new rule. We're not going to mention a reboot unless it's actually happening. So I would not have mentioned Mighty Ducks because that doesn't have a home yet. I might not mention stuff where they're just said they like the idea. Ryan Reynolds is thinking of doing it. Let's wait till it's greenlit. Otherwise, it's just too much. We wanted to make a point. Like, look at all the damn reboots coming. But there's so many of them now. It's just a tidal wave, including one more. The XFL. Vince McMahon is rebooting the football league, the XFL. Even sports can be rebooted.
Yeah, you know, when I heard that, I went, kind of vaguely remember the XFL, but like I had to go back in my memory and kind of really, okay, I actually had to Google it and actually figure out what it was.
Can you remember who won the Grammy Awards last year?
Oh, God. Wasn't it, I want to say Beck, but that was probably a couple of years ago. And wait, wasn't it Adele? Adele, is right?
Exactly, it was Adele. She won Album of the Year, beating out Beyonce's Lemonade. And that's what happened again this year, where the mainstream middle-of-the-road guy Bruno Mars beat out Kendrick Lamar and Jay-Z for Album of the Year.
Yeah, I mean, everybody thought, look, with what's going on in politics and in the world, that Kendrick Lamar's album was so vitally important and so well done. And, you know, it's really his moment. It's his moment to shine. Same thing with Jay-Z, such a confessional album. That kind of like might help change the way hip hop is done. Everybody thought these are albums that deserve to be praised and lauded and then kind of put on pedestals. And then in the end, Bruno Mars, who is, you know, let's face it, he's a star. Okay. He's no slouch.
They all are. Yeah.
In the end, it was the more straightforward kind of pop album that wound up winning. And I think, you know, as much as everybody points to the film industry and goes, oh, you know, Oscar's so white and, you know, you need your Me Too movements. Guess what? You know, it might be the music industry that should also be taking a look at itself.
Well, this is certainly not a problem with diversity.
Not diversity, but like when it comes to providing or handing out awards to some of these more edgy acts, they never tend to do it. That's why when Arcade Fire won, everybody was so shocked.
Well, I think you've got it backwards. The Oscars often goes for the art rather than the big smash commercial hits. And everybody, Hollywood's been trying to figure out a way to get the big popular movies just nominated. They can't even get them nominated.
Okay,
for
fair enough.
Wonder
yeah.
Woman. Whereas in the album world, the big albums of the year, like Adele's 25 last year or Michael Jackson's Thriller, often every 2 or 3 years, it's just the biggest album of the year that wins. And in this age of declining sales, Bruno Mars is about as big as it gets. He's certainly as big as Kendrick Lamar and Jay-Z and Lord and Childish Gambino. He's had 3 big albums in a row, tons of smash hit songs. So in a way, he's the biggest artist right now as far as commercially. He's right up there as far as the ones nominated this year. So you know what? You know, you complain that the Oscars aren't popular enough, and then you complain when the Grammys go to the big popular act.
Well, certainly one of the big complaints was, look, if Despacito can't win Record of the Year in a year like this, then, you know, then I think I saw one person say, then no, you know, Latin song will ever win Song of the Year or Record of the Year. I think that's not true. I think maybe this year It is true, obviously, because it didn't happen. But I agree. I think you and I both peg Despacito as record of the year, not song of the year, which is, of course, for a song which you'll see people cover in the future. Whereas I don't think anybody's going to be covering Despacito in the future.
Or 24 Karat Magic.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I don't think there was a clear song of the year among the five choices they had. But yeah, Despacito and 24 Karat Magic were classic sort of records of the year. Either one, you know, makes sense in terms of the production and the value. I would have picked Despacito, though, frankly, I felt like their performance sort of set the industry back in terms of female empowerment. You know, it would look like strippers on stage again. You know, come on, guys, you know.
Okay, so you're talking about Despacito, the performance by Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee. Justin Bieber wasn't there. And it's funny you should mention that, because as I was watching that performance, I looked at them and I said, they look like they are really uncomfortable right now. And it might be because they are surrounded by girls that are gyrating.
Well, they chose it. They didn't. It's like their video. It's nothing different than what they did in their video.
No, I understand that. But it's one thing to do it in a video and to put that out on YouTube. It's another thing to do it live in front of, you know.
I don't think they have any problems with it. Okay. That's the problem. They should have had problems with it. Anyway, the Grammy Awards happened. The album of the year was sort of a letdown for those who said, hey, Beyonce should have won for Lemonade. Kendrick Lamar should have won for To Pimp a Butterfly a year or two before. There was one great pick, two great picks. We talked about, is Amy Mann a folk artist? I said, no, she's not a folk artist. Well, she won the Grammy for Best Folk Album, so I guess she is a folk artist.
She's a folk artist now, gosh darn it.
And my favorite album of the year, my pick for the Best Album of the Year, also won a Grammy Award. It's for Best Jazz Vocal Album. It's Cecily McLaurin-Salvant, won for Dreams and Daggers. It's a great double album. If you like jazz, it's the best, most exciting vocal album, I think, since Cassandra Wilson broke through with Blue Light Till Dawn. So that's my pick for the best album of the year. I know the Village Voice Paz and Jot poll came out. They did give their top award to Kendrick Lamar. So there you go. But the show, no matter who won the awards, is all about the performances. And this year, it really plummeted hard. 7 million viewers turned away. It's a 19.8 million viewers in the overnights. That's an all-time low. What the heck's going on?
I wonder if maybe a couple things. One, is it too early in the year? I mean, it was even I was shocked that it was so early this year. Usually, I feel like it's after the Super Bowl or the, well, I guess this is the week before the Super Bowl. It just feels like it's a bit too early.
Well, it was the Olympics and stuff. They had to worry about scheduling.
You know what? You're absolutely right. That is exactly why they stayed. That's why they moved it so early.
Yeah. It is. They had to stay away of that train wreck, you know, that would just crush everything in its path.
Yeah, because that usually does just suck up all the viewership, especially live viewership. I also wonder if maybe there are just one too many of these, you know, performance shows where you've got, you know, X Factor or maybe that's not on anymore, but The Voice. Well, and
those don't have big stars on them, though.
Right. But, you know, then you have the American Music Awards and you have the Country Music Awards. And it just seems like there's one of these shows on every other week.
Right, and that's why they should pick their slots better. And having Sting on three times is just, you know, I love Sting. But why the hell is he singing An Englishman in New York?
Because what they're in New York.
But that's stupid. that's ridiculous. There's a million songs they could sing. Him singing that when he also was in Carpool Karaoke and he gave out an award. It felt like Sting night. He doesn't even have an album out. It just was bizarre. There were lots of poor choices, I think, in the performances. I thought it was poorly directed. I don't think viewers really key into that, but like you say, there's so many performances on TV that it's you got to work harder to be special, and I don't think they pulled that off.
What did you think? Okay, the performance everybody must be talking about today is Kesha's performance, because given the, you know, the moment, the social moment that we're having with sexual harassment and the Me Too movement and Time's Up, here is a performer, a pop artist, whose career was stalled because she was having an argument with somebody that she has claimed.
She fought with her label over sexual harassment and assault by her producer.
Correct. And, you know,
they have an argument. She was accusing him of sexual assault and rape.
Right. And they wouldn't let her out of the contract with him. And so here she is. She was let out of the contract. She does this album that's really good. There's this song, Pray, might not be Pray. I can't remember the...
Praying.
That said, she does this performance with Cyndi Lauper and other artists. Everybody's wearing white, the suffragette color. And it just, like, you know, she belts the heck out of it and knocks everybody's socks off. What did you think?
Well, the show overall, I thought, gee, I wish they'd gone more political.
Oh,
I mean,
really?
It seemed, I'm joking. It's like political at the beginning, political at the middle, political at the end. It was the most political Grammys ever, as far as I'm concerned. It was suicide prevention. It was the Dreamers. It was women's empowerment. It was politics and Trump's America with Kendrick Lamar. I thought it was just nonstop from beginning to the end. People had a purpose when they were singing, and they were not messing around. So it caught the eye of our ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley. She said, "Oh, they're ruining the Grammys with all this politics." And she was referring specifically to the gag with Hillary Clinton doing a reading from Fire and Fury. She said, "Ah, why do they have to spoil all my great music with putting in politics?" To which I thought, gee, she must really hate Pete Seeger.
Because that's all he is.
Exactly. And Aaron Rich said, "I hope no one tells her about the 60s. You know, like, music and politics kind of go hand in hand, lady." So anyway, you know, whatever. I don't think that's what the reason people turned off, because they couldn't know that was what was going to happen when they tuned in. But, you know, as always, there were good performances, there were bad performances, and not as many good ones as I would normally like.
Well, every week there are lots of books that are published. Some of them are good. And I think, I don't know if I'm stretching to say most of them are not good.
Oh, absolutely. 90% of everything is junk. It's as true for books as it is for everything else.
Well, every week, so many books come out that I don't have time to read them. I turn to bookfilter.com to find out what I should be reading, which means it is time for our book filter segment, where Michael dives into the new releases and brings us a book that's ready for its close-up. What have you got for us this week, Michael?
Well, this week I've got a nonfiction book. It's a popular history work called Jefferson's Daughters by Catherine Carrison, a professor. And it's a story about the three acknowledged daughters of Thomas Jefferson, two white and one black, and their very different paths in life. Two of the daughters were by his wife, and one daughter, Harriet, was by the enslaved woman Sally Hemings. His two daughters had, of course, a privileged education, upbringing in Paris, surrounded by intellectuals. But when they became adults, they suddenly found themselves, you know what, you're still a woman. And they were hemmed in by the limitations on women. His daughter, Harriet, however, the daughter of Sally Hemings, escaped slavery, perhaps with the help of Jefferson himself, that's what the author suggests, and ventured out into the world and had a very different life. So the book hasn't been reviewed a lot yet. It's gotten some good reviews, but it hasn't had a wave of reviews. But I did notice there were a lot of positive reader reviews. I think this book is going to appeal to women who are most of the readers in the world. I think it's Jefferson and slavery, and I think it's a great hot topic. It's ripe for a TV movie or miniseries adaptation. I think Reese Witherspoon should jump on it right away.
Well, as far as historic novels go, I'm still trying to make my way through Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders, which you recommended to us last year. But now it is time for our sexual misconduct of Palooza, which, again, we're not making light of it, but it's become such a large segment of our show here. We're going to kind of cut it down to just one allegation for this week.
Well, it's our favorite. I mean, there's so many to go through. A host on The Four, the singing competition show, just got accused in an open letter of sexual misconduct. But when you look at the hundreds of them this week, my favorite was Scott Baio. When he was on Charles in Charge, a sitcom, actress Nicole Eggert has accused him of sexually molesting her when she was age 14 to 16 years old. And then he went on Facebook Live to defend himself. And while he did that, he offered up more information that made me believe her even more. So not always a good idea to jump on Facebook Live and defend yourself, Mr. Baio.
Yeah, and I don't know if I'd say this is our favorite. We don't like doing this.
That's not the word we want. The one that struck us the most was Scott Baio, since he was a strong Trump supporter and defending him for his sexual harassment and assault of women. And therefore, it seems like pure justice to see Scott Baio involved in perhaps the same sexual misconduct.
Yeah, I would say that's, well, you know, that and Steve Wynn, they were the casino magnet. Those were the biggest stories.
Oh, Steve Wynn was a very big deal. He was a contributor to a lot of Republicans and some Democrats, but now he's the head of the RNC financial fundraising.
Not anymore.
So that's not anymore. He had to step down. So that's a really, you know, that's a big one for sure.
Oh, well, if that's a big one, then maybe you can tell me whether some of these next stories are big deals or big whoops. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. No wonder Rupert Murdoch wants to sell off a lot of Fox. He can't even get approval from the UK government to buy out the rest of Sky TV. News Corp, or whatever it's called now, has been trying to make the deal happen, but a string of scandals tossed a spanner in the works. Now a UK regulator has weighed in, and the answer is a straightforward merger is, quote, not in the public interest. A main area of concern, the Murdochs would own too much of the UK media landscape, encompassing TV, radio, print, and online, also known as everything and everywhere. Any number of options arise, and of course, if Disney bought out Murdoch's interest in Sky, the whole issue would be moot. However, the Disney-Fox merger will also face intense scrutiny. Big deal or big whoop?
I would say it's a big whoop because it's probably too little too late.
Meaning what? That
Well, you know, they're trying to finish off the tail end of this deal before they sell it off to Disney. So now suddenly they realize all the problems with how much media they control. It's just a little bit too little too late. They're going to make something happen so they can get out of all this and sell it off. So it probably won't matter in the long run.
Now, if you've been dying to hear the classic rock song Hand in Glove, backed by a full orchestra, well, you're just going to have to wait. A tour called Classically Smiths announced tickets would go on sale. Bassist Andy Rourke and drummer Mike Joyce were on board, along with the fifth Smith, guitarist Craig Gannon. Morrissey and Johnny Marr presumably had better things to do. The three plus other musicians and guest vocalists would perform alongside a full orchestra. A world tour would follow. Then Rourke said, "Wait, tour? What tour? I never agreed to any of this." Then Joyce said, "Wait, if Rourke isn't on board, then neither am I." And suddenly the whole thing collapsed and Gannon was left to lift a pint with Pete Best somewhere and wonder what might have been. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, but I love that these guys, they were in the Smiths, one of the big bands of all time, and they were going to be in this reunion thing that was happening. At least one of them thought so, though the other one dropped out. He never actually signed off on it, but he never communicated with him. He didn't even text him and say, "Hey, we're doing this tour thing." You know, like, they never spoke until the day of the press announcement about the concerts. So I just thought that was incredibly bizarre. But there were more sad news about music that's not happening, as Neil Diamond has stopped touring immediately. He's in the midst of a tour and he said, "I've got Parkinson's disease and I'm not going to tour anymore."
And that's really sad.
That's very sad because 50 years of touring and I never saw him. Elton John also announced he's retiring from touring, but he's going to take 3 years to do it. He said, "I'm not going to go back and say, here's another end of the world. I am touring for the final time for the next 3 years, and then that is it. I don't say I won't ever perform live, but I'm never going to do a big tour again. This is it." So Neil Diamond is stopping because of Parkinson's. Elton John says, "Well, I'm going to do 3 years, see me while you can, and then I'm done."
Yeah, you know, watching him last night on the Grammy Awards, I kind of looked and went, you know what? It's really hard to hit some of those notes when, you know, as you get older, it's just hard to do what he's been doing for, you know, 50 years.
Absolutely. And cue the Miley Cyrus comeback with her looking classy and elegant in her gown as she duets with Elton John on Tiny Dancer. And Elton John and Neil Diamond have a strong connection. Neil Diamond introduced Elton John during John's key early live dates in the U.S. at the Troubadour, which helped launch him forever. He said, you know, Neil Diamond was a big star and he showed up to introduce Elton John and help lend his celebrity to Elton John trying to break through the U.S. market. And he remembers it to this day and is still grateful. So he sort of gave a shout out to Neil about the sad end to touring, but Neil's going to keep recording and doing stuff musically. He's just not going to go out on tour.
Hey, maybe that Will Smith action film on Netflix wasn't so bad after all. Netflix added 8 million subscribers worldwide in the fourth quarter, more members at one time than ever before in the company's history. That's right, they've got 117 million subscribers worldwide, and the pace of new people signing up just got faster. Revenue grew 33% to $3.3 billion. Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. I wonder how much of that they get to keep. Of course, we could find out since they're public. Last fall, Netflix raised its monthly fee by $1, with 8 million new people paying about $10 a month. That's well enough money to make a Will Smith film like Bright every month for a year. The company also credits hot fare like Stranger Things, Black Mirror, Mindhunter, and The Crown for the rise in membership, which even included about 2 million more members in the U.S. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. They're spending $7.5 billion on content, $2 billion on marketing. That's $10 billion a year starting in 2018 that they expect to pay. That's a big market. That's a lot of money. That's putting a lot of people to work. And they don't see Disney and Hulu as competitors, and really neither do I. I think it's just one of many options that people have, and it's, you know, to grow at this stage and speed up is pretty amazing.
On Twitter, Michael has exactly 555 followers.
Hey, make it 556. Go to Twitter, follow me online. I'm at Michael Giltz. Do it right now while you're listening to the show.
And then go to at Sperling and follow me. Well, 555 followers isn't bad exactly, but it's certainly not impressive. If Michael was headed for a job interview or just wanted to look more popular, he could actually pay to have people follow him. Private companies set up shadow accounts that are similar to real people, making it easier to scam companies like Facebook, which just announced it estimates the site includes some 60 million fake Facebook accounts, with Twitter, so it's kind of like the number of fake listeners that we have, 60 million. Twitter and others are dealing with proportionally similar problems, by the way. Athletes, politicians, celebrities, pastors, TED speakers, you know, companies with products to promote, that stand-up comics and the like, they're all paying millions to beef up their image, including, by the way, John Leguizamo, Clay Aiken, Kathy Ireland, the guy running against U.S. Congressman Paul Ryan, film critic Richard Roper, and even British rower James Cracknell, who won Olympic gold. He bought 50,000 followers and readily admits it's a fraud. Big yellow, big whoop.
Oh my God, read this story. It is so hilarious and mind-blowing. It really is. You have companies paying big money to influencers, those people, lots of followers on Twitter or YouTube. Turns out those people are paying people to follow them. And then the companies pay for their big influence, which is fake. And the companies themselves are buying fake followers for their products. It's just like this circle jerk of, you know, of scamming. It's unbelievable. It really is a fascinating story.
And what I would say is, oh my God, just get rid of all the fake accounts and then everybody will be back down and you'll actually have true engagement. And those people will actually be influencers of real people.
Oh, and the company that one of the main companies doing this, selling fake identities, they had their own identity stolen by a copycat company. And they also, they didn't even make their own bots. They just buy them and wholesale from somebody else. And to top it off, while I was listening to this, I know our listeners haven't heard our podcast yet, but I went onto Twitter to see if maybe I'm still at 555. Somebody dropped me. I'm at 554.
Who was it? Darn it.
That's probably a Russian bot.
Well, I can tell you that this story is in the New York Times, and it's like 5 trillion words long.
It's a big graphic story. It's very interesting. I strongly recommend it.
Now, remember we talked about Ellen Pompeo of Grey's Anatomy last week?
I do.
Well, Ellen Pompeo of Grey's Anatomy is effing awesome, okay? And we're not the only ones who think so. After Pompeo was exceptionally candid about negotiating salaries and cursing a lot and what she's actually paid, other people working in TV got inspired. Someone launched a shareable Google Doc, a Google spreadsheet, and TV writers and assistants are weighing in with info. What are they paid and what's their gender and color? Hopefully, they also detail whether the show is network, cable, premium, streaming, or whatever, the number of episodes, and so on. They also detail network and studio and per-episode quotes. No one knows who started it, and all the info is anonymous. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a very big deal. Companies don't want you telling other people what you make because knowledge is power. And the more you know, the more you can be informed and fight for what you deserve.
Yeah, you know, certainly when you look at this, you know, what I liked about this list is that, you know, they actually put in what experience did each person have? Because sometimes you'll get the same person, you know, it's a female African-American, and it's like, well, why is one getting 10,000 and the other getting 14,000? It's like, well, 10 years more experience. And oh, by the way, the 3 hit shows they worked on. So,
but a lot of times you're seeing in this list that there is no good explanation for why some of the women are making less than some of the men.
Yeah. I mean, certainly I didn't go through the entire list, the most recent version of it, but there were some where I was like, oh, wow. Yeah. Look, there's some working. They both have, you know, 2 hit shows to their name, you know, and but you'll also see ones where they did the shows, but the pilots weren't picked up.
Sure.
Yeah. Or they were canceled after
a
season.
Knowledge is power. People are learning. There are discrepancies in pay. The BBC has just cut the salaries of some of their top TV newsmen. They said people were complaining that men make more than the women. And they said, okay, we'll cut the men's salaries. To which the men said, yeah. What? You know, it's great. They save money. And any man who complains looks like a jerk.
That's right.
So it's great. But no, this is not showing, this is not a spreadsheet explaining why people make less money. It's showing once you know what people make, then you have more of knowledge. And you don't wonder if you make less. You know you make less. And now you want to know why.
Indeed. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And as promised, we told you at the head of the show that we'd be joined by Ann Thompson, editor at large over at IndieWire, and she is just back from the Sundance Film Festival, where she must have been doing double duty, both predicting Oscar nominations, which she was, by the way, right about, and also covering Sundance. Anne, thank you for joining us.
Yes, I'm a little on the tired side, but here I am.
Well, Anne, you always have overnight reactions to the Oscars, and then you get to catch your breath after a few days and maybe hear what other people think. Have you had any new insights about the Oscar nominations since that first rush?
Well, what I'd say to you is that although it's still, you know, if you look at the numbers and you look at the likelihood, the nominations leader, The Shape of Water, with 13 nominations, is probably going to win, you know, the most Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. But it is fun to sort of play the game, and a lot of people are playing this game, where they try to figure out how does Get Out or how does Lady Bird, you know, get, you know, we know that Gary Oldman will probably win Best Actor. We know that Frances McDormand and Sam Rockwell will probably win their categories. But how do we, you know, which is it going to be Greta Gerwig or is it going to be Jordan Peele that wins original screenplay? That's a very intense and hard to call race. And you could even imagine, suppose they did go with Jordan Peele there. What if they went with Greta's movie for supporting actress? What if they went with Laurie Metcalf to give her a win? You know, this kind of thinking starts to, you know, this kind of speculation starts to move around, you know. And then some people say, oh, they'll give Shape of Water Best Picture and they'll give Jordan Peele Best Director, which I don't really believe would happen. I don't see anyone taking that away from Guillermo. But what if Christopher Nolan's strength in the nominations and the editing win and the fact that Get Out and Lady Bird don't have editing nominations, which is a sign of weakness, and McDonough didn't get a directing nomination, which is a sign of weakness. How do you, you know, play around and figure out a way for Lady Bird or Get Out to actually get carve out a win?
Now, Call Me By Your Name, also nominated for Best Picture, it seemed like an early front runner, but there were nine films nominated for Best Picture this year, but nobody's talking about Call Me By Your Name, and Darkest Hour seems to have surprised anybody. Were you surprised that nine films were nominated?
I thought it might be fewer because I didn't know how many people were passionate about the film, so that was a surprise to me. I thought it would be seven or eight, but the ones that were included were all expected except for Phantom Thread. Phantom Thread was the biggest surprise in the directing category and the Best Picture category and the supporting actress category for Leslie Manville. We all thought it would get costumes, and it will win costumes, I think. You know, that will happen. And the one thing that I think Call Me By Your Name will win is probably adapted screenplay. That's my guess there.
Well, I'm excited for Leslie Manville because I thought she was a terrific supporting performance. But I think since they've had the expanding, contracting nominations, we've had nine films every year except one year where we had eight. So if they're going to have basically eight or nine films, why not just say 10 and be done with it?
I say, why not go back to five and let it be, forget about this preferential ballot, which doesn't do anybody any good as far as I'm concerned.
I agree.
The whole point of this was to make it about, you know, getting more big movies and onto the list and into the Oscar show. I don't think it's had that impact at all. It's been more independent films, if anything.
We were just talking about that earlier. But now you mentioned, okay, director Guillermo del Toro is nominated, Paul Thomas Anderson for Phantom Thread, Greta Gerwig for Lady Bird, Jordan Peele for Get Out, and Christopher Nolan for Dunkirk. And I find that sometimes, like last year, you'll have La La Land win for writing and for directing, and it's racking up all these wins. And then in the end, it'll be because of this preferential ballot, it'll be some other film. Could that happen again this year?
Yes, it could. And there are those who think that Get Out is the one that will get that win because of the zeitgeist. And then others say, well, that zeitgeist was last year.
Yeah. Yeah.
This year it'll be Lady Bird. And to that, I just say those two films don't have, I know it sounds like wonky, but they don't have enough nominations, as many as Moonlight did, for example, and they don't have editing nominations. And that is a sign. So I really can't imagine either of them winning Best Picture, which leaves us with The Shape of Water, or the alternative scenario would be that the Steak Eater vote you know, the male dominated academy comes through for something like Dunkirk, which was always the original front runner and did very well and could clean up. You know, you never know.
It's a classic Hollywood film.
It is a classic Hollywood film, although I would argue that it's also slightly radical. And so you do hear more conservative Academy members complaining about radical time signature and the fact that the reason that it's not a front runner anymore is really has a lot to do with the fact that it didn't get acting nominations because none of the parts are big enough, you know, to really, it's sort of like Spotlight in that way. It's an ensemble, you know, but that didn't prevent Spotlight from winning Best Picture. So it's either the fact that the Dunkirk hasn't gotten more acting nominations is hiding its actual strength. Because, you know, Lord of the Rings didn't need acting nominations either, you know. Or the fact that it's an unconventional, weird time narrative that people can't get behind because there's not enough character development is a problem and it will prevent it from winning, if that makes any sense.
I feel like if Dunkirk had won a Best Supporting Actor nomination for Mark Rylance, I could convince myself that the movie had a really good shot to win Best Picture. I thought that was the one it might get. But since it didn't get Mark Rylance, and that's the only acting award it might have gotten, I feel like when I'm thinking maybe Dunkirk could win, I'm just kidding myself.
Well, they went with two nominations for Three Billboards, which is sort of unusual. And I have a feeling that Armie Hammer and Michael Stuhlbarg knocked each other out. They kind of split the vote for Call Me by Your Name in that category. So they may have taken one of those slots, but I don't think any of those men had enough screen time. And of course, the problem with Dunkirk is that it's a sort of, you know, throwback and Darkest Hour too, throwback to the old World War II all white male era, you know. So it could be that that's a weakness for the film as well. It doesn't quite represent the diversity message that the Academy members may want to send. But I have to say, I talked to them about Lady Bird, and I love Lady Bird, and I think it's one of the great movies of the year, and it was on my 10 best list. But there are men who, you know, consign that movie to a lifetime film. You know, I don't agree with that, but they exist.
Well, what did you think of Casey Affleck taking himself out of the presenter role for Best Actress? Normally the actor who wins Best Actor the previous year will hand out the Best Actress award of the current year. And he said, look, you know, it's I will detract from...
That's me. I wrote that.
Oh, okay.
No, he didn't say anything.
He didn't give a reason, but I would suggest that he's doing the right thing and his publicity team is making the right call. Look, let's be honest. If the whole Casey Affleck thing were to have happened this year instead of last year, which is that there was an old case, transcripts were revealed, you know, around the time of that documentary with Joaquin Phoenix. That what's it called? I'm Not There.
I'm Not There. Yeah,
I forgot. Yeah, it you know, it was pretty damning. There was a lot of fooling around and people in the wrong bed at the wrong time at his house where everybody was staying during the shooting of this sort of fly by night indie doc. And it didn't have any impact last year on his ability to win Best Actor. But if it were to have happened again this year instead, he wouldn't have been nominated, I'm pretty sure, just as James Franco wasn't nominated with multiple accusers. So I don't know. I think he probably did the right thing.
And by the way, it was I'm Still Here was the documentary.
I'm Still Here.
Yeah.
I'm Not There was the Dylan movie from Todd Haynes.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Now, Call Me By Your Name and Get Out were both at Sundance last year, and they are, of course, nominated, as we mentioned. Who should we be looking for next year to be mentioned at the end of the year? There were so many good drama films, at least from, you know, normally I'm there and I'm seeing them myself. This year I was not. But who should we be looking at? It seems like there were so many good drama films.
It's a very interesting year. I did write a piece today about the Oscar sort of an author roundup of Sundance, usually there's a lot more. You know, you had Big Sick and Call Me By Your Name and Get Out, and then you had a few documentaries as well, three, you know, Strong Island and Last Man at Aleppo and Icarus all debuted at Sundance and were picked up. Netflix hasn't picked up any docs. The only doc that I could say to you today will definitely be in the Oscar race is Won't You Be My Neighbor, the Fred Pierce movie from Morgan Neville, who won 20 Feet from Stardom, which had every audience weeping deeply throughout the movie. It had this unaccountable sort of emotional impact, celebrating a good man in a time when we need men like Ken, you know? But otherwise, I mean, there was a big neon. I looked up the Identical Strangers, which might be, you know, good enough to if they do a job with it, to be in the race later on. But there just was a sort of a sea of docs that didn't quite, you know, fit the bill. And as far as narratives are concerned, it could be none of them fit the bill. I mean, I really liked Colette, and Keira Knightley's very good. And if Leaker makes a big hit out of that, you could see her in the Best Actress race, maybe, and maybe Dominic West, who was very good. But, and I really liked the movie, but I could see that it depends. I don't know when they're opening it. I don't know when they're gonna, how they're gonna handle it. Something like Private Life, the Netflix movie from Tamara Jenkins with Paul Giamatti and Catherine Hahn, wonderful movie. Really well written, really good screenplay, really good direction, but it's on Netflix and it'll come out in the fall. They're going to put it in the fall festivals. So they're going to give it a big whirl, but you know, it's hard when it's on Netflix to get that kind of word of mouth going that you need for an Oscar contender.
So when we look at the best films at Sundance, according to Variety, they had 10 films and Hollywood Reporter picked 20, but they only had three in common. And that includes Blaze, the film that Ethan Hawke directed.
Which I loved. Absolutely, Dev. That was one of my favorites. But I don't know how to explain this to you. It hasn't gotten picked up yet. I don't know how it's going to be handled or how big it... My instinct is that as much as I love that movie, and this guy, Ben Dickey, did an amazing job playing Blaze Foley, and he's a singer. So you could compare this movie to something like Inside Llewyn Davis. It's that musically sophisticated and dependent upon music for its impact. And Aaliyah Shawkat is really great in it, and Charlie Sexton is really great in it. I just have a feeling it may not be that theatrically commercial.
Yeah, and there was That Come Sunday with Chiwetel Ejiofor and Hereditary with Toni Collette. So my question was, is it a sign of not a great year?
Hereditary is a big horror thriller, okay, that scares the shit out of people. So that's more about discovering the filmmaker, the first-time filmmaker, and that's in it really well for A24, The Witch did. And then the other one is another Netflix movie, very small, very unlikely to have a big impact.
And this is Come Sunday.
Yeah.
What about Jane Fonda in Five Acts? Of course, you know, she made some headlines up there.
Yeah, there's a couple of HBO movies which are probably going to end up being HBO broadcast. That's one of them. And then there's a Robin Williams movie from Marina Zenovich. HBO picked up this wonderful movie called The Sentence, which I loved, which is another tearjerker that had audiences on the floor crying. But it's a first-time filmmaker named Rudy Valdez who was basically shooting a home movie about the impact of sister incarceration on a minimum sentence setting a drug dealer she was dating at the time years ago, remarried and had three little girls. And
wow.
He's wonderful, wonderful little girls, and he's like videotaping them for 10 years while they grow up. It just slays you. It won the Audience Award for documentary, but it's too untouched for what you would consider an Oscar documentary. I would guess.
And then Leave No Trace from the director of Winter's Bone, Deborah Granik, who did a a documentary that I loved, the name of which is totally escaping me right now, In Between Winter's Bone.
The one about that biker guy, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like you can remember the character.
Yeah, I loved that.
I loved it too. And I thought, wow, she's a really good director. And now she's directing this movie, Leave No Trace, about a father and daughter who live off the grid in the woods. Also a film that people came out of Sundance and Park City really talking about.
All right. Deborah Granik wrote and directed Winter's Bone, which introduced, of course, Jennifer Lawrence. And that story about this powerhouse young actress sort of fueled what would have been otherwise a pretty quiet movie. This movie, from what I can see, is quieter still. So I don't know if Bleecker, and it's Bleecker again, can make this register on a big enough scale to be an Oscar contender.
We've got Oscar on the mind because that's just happened. And in Sundance, the story was always, oh, you go to Sundance, you get picked up, you go to movie theaters, and maybe you're a hit. I think it was Variety that said the Laura Dern film, The Tale, was picked up by HBO, and it's going to open on HBO. It's not going to theaters. And maybe that's okay now. Maybe that's the new
It'll
story.
Here's what's going on. You've got Amazon, you've got and Netflix, and you've got, and what's going on with a lot of these companies, and the real story is that they're all making their own movies, right? And they're not picking up something unless they really think they're, in Amazon's case, there's a theatrical case to be made for it. Really, I was sort of surprised. Maybe they'll buy something later, but not what I understand. And they didn't buy anything because they have so much in production on their own, in the indie content side, on the original content, on the documentary side. They have a huge volume of in-house production that they're putting through their online streaming site. I think a movie is going to end up either going to YouTube Red, the Amazon direct route where they pay like $200,000 to take care of the movie exclusively for filmmakers. Or it won't be in a theatrical. But the bar for entry for theatrical now has gotten much higher. It's like threading a needle to get into a theater at this stage.
Well, then you had MoviePass, a brand new acquisitions, I guess you'd say a brand new acquirer, a brand new distributor. Which
they're not a distributor. There's two companies that have made a big impact. One of them is MoviePass, which partnered with the Orchard. And they picked up
American Animals.
American Animal. Thank you. I love that movie, by the way. That was a really good movie. It just doesn't look like an Oscar movie. It's a hybrid. So it's neither fish nor fowl. It's neither a documentary nor a fiction film. It's both. A little bit like Wormwood. The same idea that you're reenacting the scene of the crime, in this case, an art heist. And then you're interviewing the people who perpetrated the crime after the fact. It's really cool. I liked it a lot. But so the distributor is the Orchard, and then MoviePass is going in with them. And the whole question of MoviePass, that was a total subject of discussion throughout Sundance and will be at CinemaCon as well, because they're really changing the game.
And what was the takeaway? Because we discussed MoviePass earlier in the show here. So what was the takeaway from Park City and Sundance this year about MoviePass? Do people like it? Do they hate it?
No, it's obviously hugely successful in terms of getting people to go back to the movies, and the theaters that are participating with it are getting they're making more money. First, they get paid the real price of the ticket, and they're making more money on the concessions, and they're getting more people to come to the movies and be in the habit of coming to the movies. The theater chains that are not participating and who are late to the party and should have done it a lot earlier, like AMC, and question of how they're going to sell their data and how they're going to share their data with the exhibition chains is the other interesting question for MoviePass. Did you guys talk about that?
Yes, indeed.
The question too is what is the benefit of participating in the distribution of a movie for MoviePass? Well, how do they pass that on to their consumers? That's what I'd like to know.
That's what makes no sense at all.
I think they may be offering those movies as part of, you know, you get an extra ticket in there somewhere.
Or they have their own streaming service, or they have, you know, they've talked about so much, one wonders if they know what they should be focused on.
Yeah.
But certainly, today we focused on Oscars and Sundance, and Anne, it is always a pleasure to talk with you after Sundance and the Oscars and moments like this, because again, you are the ultimate insider. So thank you very much for, you know, I wasn't there this year, so we only had your word to go on, so I appreciate it.
I hope you'll be in Cannes, Berlin.
I most certainly, that's like my Christmas. It would be like a year without Christmas if I didn't go to Cannes.
All right. Looking forward. We're roommates at Cannes. That's why we talk about this.
Yes. Well, thank you for taking all the time to join us.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that wraps up Inside Baseball for this week, and I really do appreciate Anne taking the time to join us. I always love talking to her, even when, you know, we see each other at screenings or around town or, you know, film festivals. It's always great to catch up with Anne. She's always so informative. And, you know, listening to Anne talk about Sundance and the Oscars, you know what really made me yearn for this work, this construction to be over with? Because, you know, I could see that our connection, our Skype connection was not doing well during that interview. So I apologize.
Yeah, I had trouble contributing.
Yes, I know. Well, not only that, but Anne was breaking up. You were breaking up. I was the only one that could speak. It was you know what? They can't finish construction of the studio fast enough. But again, that ends Inside Baseball.
And people might break up because we have some obituaries to share.
Oh, yes, that's where I was headed. I was headed to obituaries, and I was probably going to, you know, fumble the transition. So why don't you tell us who is no longer with us this week?
Well, two giants of entertainment died. One is Hugh Masekela, the South African trumpeter, known best for Grazing in the Grass, at least here in the West, but a huge figure for many years, especially as an activist. He died at 78, but he lived long enough to see his fight against apartheid succeed and Nelson Mandela become the leader of his country. So a great full life for Hugh. And also a terrific writer, Ursula K. Le Guin, died at 88 years old. And a legend in fantasy and science fiction and fiction in general. She's seen her books elevated over the decades from children's books and just sci-fi genre stuff to more and more the center stage as being an important person of letters in the United States and in the world. And so if you haven't read The Left Hand of Darkness, or the Earthsea books, that fantasy series, now's the time to start.
You know, certainly I did not know who Ursula Le Guin was, and it was front page news. So,
yeah,
you know, I'm kind of admitting my own, I don't know what you want to call it, naivete or illiteracy. I don't know. But certainly I do plan to go back and read some of her work now.
Well, that's a good idea. You'll certainly enjoy it. If you look at the library locally, I could see that the first Earthsea book was, you know, had 10 people waiting to borrow it.
Oh, really? Well, I'm sure it has more now. But that wraps up our show for this week, our very long show for this week. So thank you for kind of listening to this point. And please do listen for the next like 2 minutes, because we will tell you that all of the stories we talked about on today's show, links to all of them can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find all those ways to subscribe to us on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, or you can download podcasts. You can usually rate and review our show, and it does help us out when you do that. You can also find on our website, showbizsandbox.com, ways to follow us at showbizsandbox on Twitter or facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Or send us an email, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. And Michael Giltz has a website. Every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's noteventhechair.com.
Ah, okay. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his writing and all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.